Okay, Roger Jarman's on the end. Roger, by the way, is also president of a company called Atlantic Models, which makes great models of airplanes and particularly airliners. He's got a wonderful website. I bought a number of them to give personally to our accident investigation team, along with Sully, as a thank you for essentially watching over us and saving our skins for the last year and a half. So, Roger, how long has the Historical Flight Foundation been in existence?
Well, the idea has been around for longer than paperwork, but about a year and a half, and it was a transition from legendary airliners to Historical Flight Foundation as a 501 versus a Part 125.
Now, this started out with Carlos Gomez here, right next to Roger. Now, you actually purchased the airplane and restored it and then donated to the Historical Flight Foundation, correct?
That's correct, approximately 6 years ago.
And when did you actually take ownership of the aircraft?
6 years ago.
6 years ago.
We started 6 years ago up in St. Paul. The airplane was parked for just under 33 years.
So it didn't really fly that long in the course of its airline and life.
I'm sorry, what was
it? I said it didn't really fly that long.
Oh, no. The DC-7 came right at the very end of the piston era. It was at the beginning of the jet era, so the jets basically killed the pistons. There weren't very many piston airplanes being built right after the jets came out.
Now, you took over an airplane that had literally sitting on the ramp for 33 years. I would imagine that couldn't have been in a very good condition. I would think it probably couldn't be restored after sitting out in the weather for that long. Was that a problem? A lot of corrosion?
Well, it did have a lot of skin corrosion. Our concern was mostly that the aircraft was structurally sound and good enough to be ferried back down to Miami. And after just spending a couple days going through the airplane, we just made a decision to go ahead and acquire the aircraft and start our work.
Lost my video feed there, I guess. That's what I was playing with there. So, was talking about doing this, I was telling some of the people down at the airport where I keep my airplane, Broadhead, Wisconsin, and I was talking with a fellow that keeps an airplane there, and his dad was a Delta pilot and flew DC-7s. And he was telling me, at least at Delta, they had a joke about how you tell a difference between a DC-6 and a DC-7. And it referred to the fact that these Wright engines were very complex and essentially didn't, they failed a lot. And the joke was, the way you tell the difference between a DC-6 and a DC-7 is DC-6 is a four-engine airplane with three-bladed props, and a DC-7 is a three-engine airplane with four-bladed props. Have you found a lot of mechanical problems with the 3350?
I don't find a lot of mechanical problems. I find a lot of stories. I think that, it's a fact. When the airlines operated it, you got to remember that they were chasing speed. So when you look at the old magazine advertisements, they were trying to show how fast you can make it from the East Coast to the West Coast. So when you look at the performance and the kind of power that they were pulling on these engines, I mean, they were cruising at doing 175, 180 BMP, doing 2400 RPM. That's what we climb at today. I mean, the fact that we don't find high-octane fuel, the 115, 145, and now we operate with 100 low-lead, they've derated these engines, and that's been really their lifesavers.
So essentially, if you run them at lower horsepower, you really just don't have a problem with them like they were having
absolutely.
Back then.
Absolutely, without a doubt.
So, Frank, what kind of speeds do you actually get out of it? What does this cruise at?
About 240 knots is what we did coming up here. And we run it really low. It clicks right along.
And what kind of altitude would you be at?
And we run 10,000 feet or below almost all the time. We figure if somebody wants to go high, they'll get in a jet plane.
Okay. It is pressurized through the airplane. And what I thought was really interesting was the smoking lounge in the back of the airplane. Did they actually sell those seats, do you know? Or was that just...
You mean, did they use it that way?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I think you could light up a cigar back then, a Havana cigar even.
In the ashtrays, obviously they could hold cigars, and I couldn't imagine seven people smoking a cigar in such a space that's hardly bigger than a port-a-john. You probably wouldn't even have to light up your own cigar.
Well, my early memories are that they used to give you a 5-pack of cigarettes when you got on board an airplane.
Really?
Yeah. That was gum for the kids and cigarettes for the adults.
So is it difficult to get a type rating in an airplane like that, an older airplane like that?
Is it what?
Is it difficult to find somebody to give out type ratings in an older airplane like that?
Yes. Yes, it is. The agency has had a real difficult time keeping up with it. The EAA has a program that they've developed with the FAA, National Designated Pilot Examiners, just to solve that problem. And that helps a whole lot.
Now, Glenn, do you have a PIC type rating in the DC-7?
No, I do not. I have the SIC limitation on mine.
So first officers, you actually have to have a type rating, but it's a second in command type rating.
In this capacity, I do to fly for Historical Flight Foundation, or it's an international requirement as well in many countries.
Okay, is that just to fly overseas? Because I know domestically you don't have to have
and that's correct.
Second-in-command type rating.
The Historical Flight Foundation does have it as part of their training program, though.
So how old are you?
I'm 22.
How many other 22-year-olds think that fly DC-7s, DC-3s, DC-4s?
Well, it's such a privilege. At the end of the day, who else, period, can say they've flown a DC-7?
Carlos. I was thinking about, how do you get a flight engineer rating? How do you find somebody to train you to be a flight engineer in something like that, a piston engine airliner?
Well, I started off by buying an airplane. So I figured I had to get checked out as engineer. I was just having this conversation today. I normally look for the younger guys that are mechanics, and you start spending time with them. Working them up. I mean, trying to go the other way around. I mean, the people that actually used to fly these airplanes as engineers in the airlines, they're much older today. And the problems that you have is that, when you're starting to dip wings, trying to do, check your oil quantities, it's kind of, I'm always fearful that someone's going to fall off the wing.
And break a hip. Yeah. Now, obviously you had to get this airplane recertified with the FAA. In fact, you just flew it, was it July 4th? Was that the first flight?
Actually, it was. It was July 4th. We went out and took it out. I think it was about for 40, 45 minutes. And then we took it out again. It was the night before we brought it up here. This airplane has probably flown, I haven't added it up, but it's about 13, 14 hours in 40 years.
Wow.
That's about what it's done.
Was the certification process just as difficult with the FAA, or do they have that?
Actually, it wasn't too difficult for us because we already operate the 4, the 6, and the 7 as freighters. So this was just adding on. It was adding on a 7, but it was a passenger 7. So a lot of that stuff was all new to us, with the regulations and what have you. But, we had to go through, we put slides on the airplane, emergency lighting, emergency pathway lighting. We had to depressurize the airplane to kind of get out of the cockpit voice recorder issue. We had to put TCAS on the airplane. So all this took place within the last 3 weeks. So the question was asked, Carlos, are you sure we can do this? And I just sat there and said, I don't know how, but we will.
So the airplane is permanently depressurized then?
It could be put back in the pressurization, but there's no need for it. For the type of flying that we're going to be doing, as Frank said, if you want to climb up to 10,000, go buy a ticket.
Mm-hmm. I know at one time in my past, I flew Convairs, which are piston engine airliners. And of course, this was for a freight operator. So, maintenance wasn't exactly top notch. And I remember we always used to be upset because when things like the compressors would fail, that's it. Now it's going to be an unpressurized airplane for the rest of its life. And we'd have to be sucking on oxygen tubes rather than, living in luxury flying over the Rocky Mountains. So pressurization was important to us. So Roger, what are the future plans for the Historical Flight Foundation?
Well, originally, the Part 91 exemption is the living history flight that lets us conduct 1 hour or trips of within 50-mile radius of any airport, as which we kind of laughed at as living history, and we could not use the word sightseeing, so we just asked if we had to cover the windows so nobody could look outside. But the first thought, anyway, was living history within a 50-mile radius. And in the course of the project, from the beginning, we had inquired about doing a 125 so that we could operate from city to city. And they said that was not available. It was the Living History Program, which was fine. But as we got into it and we realized with this size of airplane, not to have some of the safety features that are in larger airplanes would just be asking for trouble. We felt like we were blazing a trail and nobody would follow if we did it wrong. Nobody could follow if we did it wrong. And so with putting the slides on the airplane and the other safety features that we had, when the FAA came in, and I must say they've been great partners in this, and it's one of the few times in my memory that I can say I believe the government agent when he said, "I'm here to help you." When they came in and saw what we had done, thank you, if that's FAA, thank you. But when they had seen how far we had gone with it, they said, "Well, why didn't you apply for 125? We said, "Well, where were you 6 years ago?" So anyway, we went on and bringing it up to 125, like Carlos said, putting in the lighting in the floor and TCAS and whatnot. We've ended up being a two-part operator. One is the 125. If people are familiar with the Nomads Flying Club, we can fly city to city, and we can also do the living history at local airports. The thing that's key in the whole thought behind the Part 91 was that they could be self-sustaining. And this airplane consumes 500 gallons of fuel an hour. It needs the ability to offset those city-to-city moves, and this is just a great program. So we'll be touring the U.S. This year, next year, and probably 2012, go to Europe and tour Europe with it.
Oh, great.
So, come so on
tour
down.
Europe? You're going to take it to Europe?
Yeah.
Wow.
Why not? Well, Frank took a DC-3 over there, the last Breitling DC-3, over the North Atlantic, and you know, lots of other people preceded him.
Mm-hmm.
And the DC-7 is transatlantic airplane, and no reason not to.
So now you you did all this work in Miami. So you had to get the airplane so you could ferry it to Miami. Now, unfortunately, I lost my video feed here, so I can't show you the pictures that I had about them doing this literally out on the ramp up in Minneapolis, fortunately in the summer. But I assume you had to get a ferry permit then? To fly it?
That's correct.
Frank, did you fly it?
Yes, we did.
So I did that give anybody any kind of pause to hop in this airplane that hasn't flown in 33 years and take it off and fly it to, you know, down to Miami?
No, Carlos and I have had a deal for a long time. If he'll fix it and engineer it, we'll fly it down. And it was the way it ought to be.
It did to everybody else, though. When we saw about six fire trucks out there, about three ambulance trucks sitting waiting for us, we were trying to figure out who they were waiting for.
Well, now, I heard that some members of your family, Carlos, weren't as confident about the
Oh, that's correct. I mean, my mom's pretty vocal in her opinions. So I did get a phone call like about a week before we were scheduled to depart from her. And she was just bawling, and she said, "Your father says you're going to kill yourself." My father's out working with me. So I just sat there, and I said, "No, Mom, that's not true." So she started addressing, "Your father says all these things need to be fixed." I said, "No problem, we're going to fix them." So she says, you promise?" I said, "Absolutely, we're going to fix them." So as soon as I hung up the phone, I ran over to go see my dad, and I said, "You got to stop calling home. If you make one more phone call, you're going to go home." I said, "I don't need any more problems."
Well, now, Roger told me about that phone call. Maybe you
could... If we can pick up... Yeah. First of all, you also put a bunch of St. Christopher medals all over the airplane. and hid them so they couldn't remove them. But anyway, Carlos's mom said, call me when they get ready to take off. And like any good husband, he did. And she heard the noise of the engines, and she said, well, how's it doing? What's it look like? And he says, I don't know. I'm standing in the port-a-john. I can't look. And he literally would not come out of the port-a-john until it was he could hear it being airborne. So he heard it, but he didn't ever see it.
Say, I heard something when I was talking with them yesterday, which I thought was quite interesting. I don't remember this. I didn't remember this from flying in Convairs. I'm sure we didn't have this, but apparently it's something that's required in a DC-7. Frank, could you tell me what the smoke card is?
No, I can't.
Well, you can't? O'Brien was telling me about it.
That's why we have co-pilots. I know all that stuff.
Oh, okay. Well, I guess I'll have to. He was telling me that they issue a smoke card, and it's got, you know, everything from white to black and gradations on it. And, you know, if the engine's smoking, you're supposed to go back there, look out the window, hold the card up, and see where on the card it is. And, of course, white is don't really sweat it, and black is, you know, you better get this thing on the ground as fast
as you
can.
Frank calls it the bailout pitcher.
That's the bottom one says black smoke, orange flame, corrective action, bailout. And that's the one you need to know.
So Roger, are there any future plans for the Historic Flight Foundation outside of this particular aircraft?
Well, I think if we ever quit dreaming, we may as well get buried. We have a lot of thoughts about it. There's several other people that have gotten excited about what they've seen and offered their aircrafts. You know, people who've purchased an airplane and it's just still sitting there after 20 years, and they see maybe there's some hope if they pass it over to us. Looks like we may be getting a Lockheed 12A, and good Lockheed 12A. But we also have a lead on a C-46 and a Super DC-3 down in Bolivia from the Canedo family. They have two exquisite airplanes. Mr. Canedo is 78 years old, and I asked him why he wanted to get rid of the airplane. He said he wanted to spend some time with the family. So we may be beneficiaries of that. But the Historical Flight Foundation really wants to not let the world forget what our heritage is. There's no reason for it. And we're going to do our level best to maintain that. We've had too much fun these last 2 days watching people and listening to the other people who flew the airplane and the youngsters that are coming in, and just amazed at the amount of room.
And I think that probably you've understand from the conversation here that they're committed to actually keep these airplanes flying, not just sitting on a ramp someplace, you know, dropping oil on the pavement so that people can look at them. You want to fly the airplanes, correct?
Everything that we would acquire is for flying. And then a little bit longer term is Miami is very rich in aviation. Too many people to name here, airlines and aviators. But the last American airframe manufacturer has offered to supply us with jet airframes for static display. But there's no reason not to have a real airline museum in Miami, and that's what our goal is. The prop liners will fly, the jets will be static because they're no good. But we'll still be flying ours. We have a lot of dreams.
Now, you got a lot of, obviously, fundraising is something that you're constantly doing. You're doing here by having people walking through the airplanes at the EAA. That's obviously got to be very difficult moving forward, keeping the money to keep these things operating. So you do sell memberships in the Historic Flight Foundation, correct?
Yeah, the membership, you don't have to fly on the airplane if you buy a membership, but you're allowed to. A $250 annual membership, number one, makes it legal under the Part 125 to fly from A to B or city to city. From here, we're going to be going to Ypsilanti probably on Sunday. And then on Monday, we're going to hop over to Detroit Metro and take the airplane into Nomad's hangar. And that'll be for the first time in 40 years that they've seen it. And then we'll be hopping back to Yip. But in any of those little city hops, members can participate and come with us. And from there, we go to Teterboro, and we'll be giving local rides in the area. So memberships allow you to go city to city. If you want to go local rides, it's $300 for 1 hour. And the last thing that I want to really make a point is one of the advantages of 50 seats in the airplane is we believe we're all entrepreneurs, and as an entrepreneur, you eat what you make. And we believe that this airplane is very self-sustaining, and it can also help sustain other museums. So we want to be able to go to other museums and take it in for joint venture fundraising. We believe this is an airplane that needs to be shared across the board. We've got flights scheduled with Miami Children's Hospital for fundraising, the Wings Club in New York. They're trying to figure out how to get Mayor Bloomberg on it to raise some big bucks for their scholarship funds. So any and everybody is welcome to come and join us to help us help you.
And if you haven't been through it yet, you know, you can go through it for, $5, I think?
$5.
And they're selling T-shirts, they're selling all kinds of things, puzzles, you know, which would make nice gifts over there. And I'm sure that they would not mind at all if somebody joined and became a member of their organization. And in fact, I think I'm going to do that myself right now.
Thank you.
Whoops, I'm sorry.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I apologize for that.
Me too.
And I said I was only going to have one beer at dinner.
I didn't sign it, you notice.
Thank you very much.
Now, you had some people you wanted to thank, didn't you?
I'm sorry?
You had some people that you wanted to thank.
Yeah, we're up here, and I'm also going to say something that you may not like. Jeff is a part of two crew members in a cockpit. We're part of these three, or three members in the cockpit. But you also have on the ground the cabin crew, the ground crew, everybody that makes this work. We have people that are volunteering their own time to be here to help us and support us. And each and every one of those need to be recognized. Porfirio, Chaco, Martin, Carol, girls, boys and girls. Good. I'd like, this happens because of everyone here, not for us up here on the stage. And all of these guys need to be recognized. And I've never known so many ex-Eastern people, but Carol and Julie and Sonia have all flew for Eastern. Sonia, believe it or not, flew on that 7, worked the 7, I should say, back in Eastern's time. So we have a lot of dedicated people and supporters, and it's really heartwarming, and how could you not love them for it? So please, thank you, everybody. Parate. Okay.
And there's one more.
Thank you. Yes.
I'm sorry. I didn't interrupt you, did you? There's one more part to this story, and this is more personal to me. You know, in the course of Sully's, the trip that we flew before we crashed in the Hudson, you know, that was the only time I ever flew with Sully, up till then. It was the first leg, and one of the things you do as an airline crew is you try to find out about each other. You know, you ask, where are you from? You know, you have kids, that kind of thing, and eventually the conversation gets down to other things. And, you know, Sully asked me, while we were flying our first leg out to San Francisco, Sully asked me something I thought was kind of odd, because he asked me, he said, well, what did you do before you got hired at US Air? And, of course, that's been so long in the past for all of us, it's not really something anybody asks anymore. And I said, well, this guy's like an Air Force Academy grad, right? You know, F-4 Phantom fighter pilot. And I said, well, you know, I flight instructed and, worked for a cargo airline, flying Convairs. And Sully immediately perks up and he says, R-2800s? And I said, well, yeah. You know, I'm thinking, like, so on. Once again, this guy's an Air Force Academy grad, and he flew jet fighters. And he starts, talking about, the sound of round radial engines. He says, man, it's always been my dream to someday fly a DC-7. And, you know, I'm thinking, I thought, well, that's kind of an odd thing for somebody of his history to say, but you know, I guess that's, you know, that's fine. And I'd forgotten about that until I happened to email him about these models that we jointly bought for those accident investigation people. And as soon as he found out that there was a DC-7 here, he immediately called Tom Poperesny to arrange that it fly. And now it's scheduled for Thursday, I believe, at 9 a.m. in the morning.
Wheels up at 9.
It's Sully and I and Administrator Randy Babbitt will be flying in it. His father flew DC-7s for Eastern Airlines, and he's very excited about it. And, you know, in fact, I never didn't really understand, you know, Sully's great love affair for, you know, round radial engines, given his personal history. But, you know, I think that maybe, you know, he can probably tell us about that himself. Can't you, Sully?
So who used to work for Eastern? Which of you? All of you. You know, well, first, I want to tell you, I almost worked for Eastern Airlines, but they turned me down. So here we are. But it was a great airline, absolutely. And it's great to meet all of you. And I want to thank you for restoring part of our heritage and for understanding it and helping the rest of us honor it as well. And thank you also for giving us a chance to go for a ride in a wonderful, beautiful airplane. And yes, you're right. There is nothing like the sound of those engines. And I grew up in a small town in North Texas, and it was a big deal in those days to go all the way 75 miles to the big city of Dallas to what was then the major airport, Love Field, and see these magnificent airliners take off for distant, exotic destinations like Tulsa and Oklahoma City, and maybe even New York or California. It seemed like a different country. In fact, my dad's mom, my paternal grandmother, had a sister in Los Angeles, and she used to go on American all the time. And I'm not sure if it was a B or a C, but it seemed like about every 10th trip taking off out of Los Angeles to bring her back to Dallas or Fort Worth, they had separate airports in those days, they would lose one, and it would be a four-bladed, three-engine airplane for a while, and they would dump fuel on the Pacific and come back and land. So I have a question for you, Carlos. Was it, I know this, the DC-7C, they called the Seven Seas when they marketed it for international travel, a bit longer fuselage, longer wings, longer range. Did they must have upped the power from those engines and that turbo compound system, or was it essentially
the same?
It was the same. So they just operated it at a higher weight.
It was originally certified for 144,000 pounds takeoff weight.
Wow.
And the B models was originally 126. Today we operate it at, 116.9.
Wow. Okay, yeah, so at its gross weight, it would be almost the same as an Airbus 319.
You know, most people forget that the 7B was your fastest prop liner built.
Faster than the Constellation.
It's faster than the Constellation.
Very cool. Well, great. It's wonderful. It's an honor to be on the stage to share this with you, and I just can't thank you enough for doing important work.
We thank you, and thank you for yours.
All right.
And we hope you all get up early on Thursday now, and because they'll be pulling the airplane out before 9 o'clock. You'll be able to see it go out here on the throat here, and see, of course, hopefully Sully and I and Administrator Babbitt climbing the stairs up into it for a short flight around the Oshkosh area. We'd like to thank you for coming out here to listen to us tonight, and have a nice evening.